From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made when one of the Vanderbilt family heirs hit the gas pedal. William Kissam Vanderbilt II spent huge amounts of money on some of the country's first automobiles, going as far back as 1899, and he wanted to go fast. Author and historian Dan Albert recounts the tale of Vanderbilt once hitting 92 miles per hour at Daytona in a rickety car that had, quote, the structural integrity of a soapbox derby car. He tore up the roadways in Newport, Rhode Island, and he once told an interviewer that inheriting wealth is death to ambition. Really, only driving fast for him gave him a thrill. But Albert writes that this decades-old need for speed could finally be coming to an end. He writes, quote, more than a century later, led by Uber, Lyft, Tesla, and others, Silicon Valley is selling the dream of the driverless car. Its proponents tout its potential to save lives, ease traffic, and free us from the scourge of driving. Robot cars, they say, will let cities tear up parking lots. Robots never rest, and replace them with affordable housing. Some describe them as a dream long held, a burning desire that at long last automakers have the technology to fulfill. But driving is dangerous, and we like it that way. We may never love driverless cars the way we love the recklessness of being behind the wheel. End quote. Albert's new book is called Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless. And of all people, it was notorious anti-car mogul Howard Decker who sent us the book. Howard is a recovering gearhead and a board member of the Community Design Center of Rochester. And this hour, we're talking about what the cars of the future look like, how they function, what it means for us, and whether we ought to do it just because we can. My guests include, is that fair? Are you a recovered gearhead, Howard Decker?
I'm a mostly recovered gearhead.
A fully recovered gearhead.
Pretty close to fully recovered.
Pretty, yeah. It's great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for asking.
And Dan Albert is on the line with us, the author of Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless. Dan, would you put yourself in that category?
Oh, I'm afraid I'd have to, although I will say gearhead is a bit of a slur in some sectors, and I tend to like the term car guy, which I use in a non-gender-specific way.
So. Okay. Well, it's great having you, and thank you for taking the time, and I must say, Howard Decker is quite a discerning consumer who cares very deeply for his community, so for him to give his stamp of approval to this book, or at least his stamp of interest. What did you make of this book, Howard Decker?
Well, I love Dan's book, and I offer my thanks to him for writing it in the first place. I think, you know, it's a really, Dan offers us a really concise, wonderful, readable, and enjoyable look at how we got to be in the mess we're in, how we've actually leveled our cities, paved the countryside, sprawled all over everything, why we did it, and how we did it, how long it took, and who made all the money while
now,
we did it.
Now, before I turn to Dan, listeners, you may be going, well, are you? That's a pejorative, Howard Decker. The mess we're in, maybe I don't think we're in a mess. The reason Howard Decker thinks we're in a mess is because in this county alone, we're sitting here right here in Monroe County, and I know, listeners, you're listening to a lot of different counties. I'm in Monroe County, where there's 600,000 people. How many automobiles are here?
There's 750,000 people, 600,000 cars, and 50 square miles of parking.
50 square miles of parking.
Right.
That's a remarkable amount of acreage just devoted to the parking lot. And so that's why Howard thinks it's a mess. Does that sound like a mess to you, Dan Albert?
Oh, absolutely. I think we're in a disastrous mess. It is, you know, to put some more numbers on it, there are more vehicles in the country than there are people licensed to drive them, which I love because it means even if we all do our part and get out there and drive, we still need a lot of those parking lots for the leftover cars. But yeah, no, absolutely, it's a mess. And I think I try to do two things. So I think we're very much in sympathy, and I've looked at the work that goes on in Rochester, and it's, you know, it's exciting to see a new urbanism developing around the country. But I try to do two things. One is to be mindful and respectful of the people who, you know, our forebears who got us into this mess, because I think they did it for a lot of good reasons, and they were responding to the world they lived in and the problems it had. And then I think on the other side, when I hear all these promises about how the driverless car is going to save the world, I'm very skeptical that somehow they're going to lead us out of this mess, because I don't see it happening in the way it's being done today.
Well, let me say that looking at Dan's work, I see a number of things that we ought to cover this hour that I think listeners will probably have a lot to say about as well. Number one, it's the culture issue. And Dan raises this point, whether it's the anecdote, the story that I raised that he reported on William Kissam Vanderbilt II, this idea of the need for speed and going fast. But there are so many people who still tie identity to vehicle, and marketing agencies still tie our identities to whatever we choose to drive, and if we're truly heading into a driverless future, what that means for us. Then there's the question of the technology itself, why this is happening at all, which I think you have latched onto, Howard, this question of, well, why are we doing this? What's really behind this? And I think we ought to hit both of those big questions. Let me just start with the culture. I mean, Howard, you can give up a car. It's not, you don't make your identity by the car. But you're not so myopic to think that that's true for everybody. How hard do you think this would be to move into a future?
It's going
to
be very difficult, I think. I think that Dan makes very clear, and his narrative is covers a long span of time quite clearly. And I think he makes it very clear that we've been at this business of inculcating the notion of car into our lives for a long time. And we've come to identify freedom and license and liberty and all sorts of kind of personal goods with the notion of being able to drive a car. And so it's become a very deeply ingrained part of our understanding of what it means to be an American to have and to own and drive a car. But we are coming to a point where we're going to have to consider, for a whole variety of reasons, some of which are extremely compelling, we're going to have to consider alternatives. And that's when the driverless car starts to show up on the horizon of things that we can look forward to possibly in the future.
Okay. How about the culture for you, Dan? I mean, I know you've written extensively about this, but let's talk about that. I mean, for everybody who gets excited about their next car purchase, I'm dreading it, by the way. I've got 191,000 miles on my car, and I'm going to spend hours this weekend trying to figure out if I can fix a catalytic converter without buying a new one. That's literally what I'm going to do, which maybe Dan's going to tell me you can't.
He's got a great piece. You should read the book again because he's got a wonderful piece about a 2-hour repair taking 3 days.
I know. And that's about to be my life. But the bottom line is if I have to get a new automobile, I am dreading it. But Dan, for the people who love it, who can't wait, who think about hitting the open road, all those things that you have written about, what's your message for a culture that's going to have a hard time parting with this?
I really do try to not divide the world into two sides. And this clearly happens now and for very good reason. You know, I follow a lot of people in the bicycling community, urban development communities, and then also, if I can call them this, the car and driver types. The antagonism that has developed and the sense that anybody who drives an SUV is been duped by the auto companies and on the other hand, that anybody who rides a bicycle is un-American, I think is kind of indicative of where we are in a broader sense of the culture. But I think also we need to recognize that, you know, people drive SUVs for what are for them very reasonable reasons. They believe they need it for going to the ski cabin, or they need the space, or they need the sense of protection, or even they just like it. And you know, it's very hard for one person to say, oh, I know better. I know better than to buy an SUV, but you don't. That is not a good way to begin a conversation. That said, I think you know, people really do need to understand that for all our excitement about freedom and mobility through the automobile, it's actually the most restricted part of our lives, right? I mean, where else do you see a police officer except when you get pulled over? Where else do you have to go? Actually, I'm not sure how you do it there in Rochester, but I know we have to go once a year and get a sticker and have them stick something up the tailpipe and all of that. So there's so many aspects of our automotive lives that are, in fact, the opposite of free, right? And I think as you begin to paint that picture, and as you begin to paint the picture of the violence that you talked about with Willie Vanderbilt, people become more educated and more understanding about what this thing that they love really is and what it means. So I don't, you know, in any way complain about anybody who wants to take a road trip. I write about great road trips. But I also think people can get beyond the basic kind of bumper sticker feeling about automobiles to a deeper understanding. And then hopefully we can begin to have a real conversation about where we are.
And I would add, Evan, uncharacteristically for me, perhaps one of the reasons why I like Dan's book so much is because, just as he says, it's very fair-minded. It's very balanced, and it gives car owners their due as they deserve. We're coming to a point where we're looking at some fairly difficult times ahead, which may cause us to make lots of big changes in our lives. And we need to take into consideration exactly what Dan has just said, which is some people have A, legitimate needs, and even B, legitimate desires to see the car culture continue unchanged, untouched, just as it has. It's not going to be possible for that to happen, I think, in the future. We're going to face change, and then the question becomes, how do we make that transition between where we are today and where we need ultimately to be in the next decade or two decades?
Yeah, and so tying a number of threads together, we are a country that has seen increasing income inequality. And so for a growing number of Americans, if they can afford an automobile, it can be a significant payment and a chunk of whatever income they have.
And we learned that affordable housing used to be defined as housing that required 30% of a person's annual income. And now we're seeing that car ownership, especially for poorer Americans, is at least 30% of their annual income. So it's becoming not only difficult for a whole bunch of environmental reasons, but it's becoming very expensive.
And that's why this book is, I think, so valuable, because it's not just fun and interesting and well-written. The history gives us a lot of explanation for how we got here. Because, you know, as I look around the current landscape, I may think, well, if it's so hard to afford for a lot of people, there's so many transit options. The rest of the world uses a lot more different transit options than we seem to. How did we get here? And then I hear about names I've never heard of, Alfred P. Sloan Jr., you know, people like that who introduced different ways of buying a car and financing and trying to roll off things off the line to change the image in the early days of car buying as something that went from elite to more accessible. Dan, you know, that shift, you know, we created a society where people started to think of themselves as potential car owners when it wasn't necessarily always going to be that way.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, obviously the two important names there are Alfred Sloan, you mentioned, at General Motors, and then also Henry Ford. And I kind of put them, you know, one after the other, where Ford sort of issued the standard Model T to every American and said, you know, this is the universal car, the only car you'll ever need. You never need to buy a new one. And Sloan came along in the 20s. And by this time, you have to understand, there were an awful lot of Model Ts around, as well as a lot of other cars,
millions,
which meant there were a lot of used cars. So Sloan said, well, how are we going to make some money here? And there were two things. One is this idea of planned obsolescence. You need a new car because you need a new car. You know, your old car may get you from point A to point B, but come on, you want to be up to date. And then two, the car loan. And so it becomes really the foundation of what was then called buying on time and today is called debt or, buying on credit. And car companies don't really make their money selling cars anymore. They make their money through finance arms and through repairs and other things, selling used cars at dealerships. But to just build a car and sell a car these days doesn't make much sense. So they've always been looking for something other than basic transportation to sell, and that's what Sloan did. He came up with the idea of planned obsolescence. Your three-year-old Chevrolet doesn't look as good as your new Chevrolet. And then he also came up with this idea, not just of being a car owner, but of owning a little bit of luxury. So if we go back to 1927, Cadillac introduces, which is part of General Motors, introduces the LaSalle. And the LaSalle is supposed to be a custom car built on a mass production assembly line. So now you have mass luxury, and that was very, very important. So people not only wanted the new car, but they wanted to work their way up the ladder, just as they might want to work their way up the career ladder to get the best possible car.
Well, before I get to some of your feedback from listeners, the question then becomes, and the book is taking us into the future, only the word future on the cover of the book is replaced by driverless. Howard, do you accept that this is an inevitability? And then the question is, why are we moving in that direction?
It seems like we're headed towards driverless cars more quickly even than we might anticipate. And if we are thoughtful, as Dan so clearly says, and careful, and we think about this thing properly, it can be a huge, huge benefit to us all. It can also be a nightmare. One of the things that Dan makes clear in the book is that the automobile industry does not exactly have the world's best record when it comes to producing manufactured items that are safe. And so the safety of the driverless car is really at issue. And the safety of all of us who are not in a driverless car is also at issue. So there's all kinds of interesting problems. I think one of the things that I absolutely was flabbergasted at that I learned from reading Dan's book was that the automobile industry, as he's just said, makes their money these days from financing and not from making cars. So if they stop making cars, that wouldn't be such a problem because it's the financing side of the equation where their money is made. And perhaps that's one of the things that's driving driverless cars as much as any other. Uber and Lyft are now ride-sharing companies, and what do they want to do most of all? They want to get rid of their labor. They want to get rid of their drivers. Why? Because paying drivers is not profitable. And so, in the end, one of the things that's motivating the development of driverless cars is to cut labor costs and increase profit. And so that's an interesting proposition, but that certainly is one aspect of where we're headed. And, of course, the technology is still, at the moment, imperfect and incredibly expensive. But that could change very, very quickly, as it did when Henry Ford invented the first Model A or Model T, and when Thomas Edison invented the light bulb and so on. So these things can change very quickly. But I want to ask our visitors, our listeners, to imagine not owning a car. And that's a very radical idea at the moment. But imagine if you don't own a car. Imagine that the automobile industry doesn't sell cars. They sell rides. And now we're talking about ride sharing and ride systems. And that's a different world. But in the back of my head, I sense that may be where we're headed.
Agree, Dan Albert. Yes or no?
Well, I agree that they're coming, and driverless hailed rides are coming. And for all the reasons mentioned, the car companies, you know, look at valuations on companies like Uber or even, you know, Netflix, and they say, aha, that's the model. Stop making stuff and start selling people a service. And that's what's called mobility as a service. So it would be much more profitable. I think, you know, when we ask people to imagine not owning a car, we also have to ask them to imagine, and I hope the listeners can answer that, but imagine what the world then looks like around them. You know, we talk about income inequality and the difficulty of owning an automobile, and they have gotten more expensive. On the other hand, not having an automobile in this landscape is a huge, you know, there's a huge downside, huge expense in time and money if you don't own a car. And so will the world be transformed into a world where not only will you not own a car, but you won't need to own a car and you'll still have all that same access to work and play and so forth that you now enjoy with your privately owned automobile?
Listeners have a lot to say, and we're going to start weighing in just a second. The last point that I'll just make to Dan Albert before we get a couple of listener phone calls is, and you sort of are a little cheeky about this, I think, in the book, but if there is this adherence to the car and to the big car and to the power of cars as this American thing, we might point out that this car culture was not something that we invented. In fact, where was the first car culture, Dan?
Oh, absolutely, in France. And when the first cars came over, as you mentioned, Willie Vanderbilt, you know, these were $250,000 cars by modern standards. And it was always going to be a rich, elite, you know, racing and enjoying the mechanisms kind of thing. You know, young men running around doing what young men tend to do, which is be gearheads, if I can call them that. And so it was adapted when it came to the United States into this democratic machine, you know, through mass production and also through, instead of these big, heavy, highly powered European models, lighter weight, lower powered American style vehicles. Oldsmobile was one of the first successful ones. And so that is the democratizing influence of the automobile. And I think we need to remember that and accept that for all of the damage that has been done, and it's quite evident, and for all the mendacity and criminality of the car companies, they did produce a machine that led to enormous increases in economic well-being, material wealth, and a transformation of the society in ways that people really did want. So the American automobile and the American car culture, one in which the vast majority of people own cars, is in a lot of ways uniquely American and uniquely democratic.
Well, still, though, I think maybe we ought to just say the next time you're enjoying a plate of Freedom Fries, getting ready to go back on the road in your massive car, and you think, no one's going to tell me what to do, I think the argument should be, do you really just want to follow France's lead?
That's right. Yeah, the America First types don't want to hear that it's France first when it comes to cars.
To the phones we go, and Rich in Rochester first. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, Evan, how you doing?
Very good, sir.
There's one point I want to make, and then a question I want to ask. When we talk about driving as a service, I'm in the computer industry, and as things become service over time, they become more expensive. The streams of revenues and everything for the car companies would be so much better and stronger. So I have no doubt that it's going to go that way. My concern is the stratification that this is going to cause. And my question is, I've heard of the Firestone and GM, would you say, conspiracy in California where they work to get rid of the trains and the subways. Is there any other historical sort of conspiracies where car companies make concerted efforts to emaciate trains or to emaciate public transportation for profit?
Thank you, Rich. Urban legend or reality? And what would you say there, Dan?
Urban legend. And it's a fascinating one. You can even look it up on Wikipedia. The story is, and for anyone who's reading Roger Rabbit, they know this story.
Yeah.
Right? The streetcar tracks of L.A. were ripped up by a conspiracy with General Motors. And the companies were, in fact, found guilty of a conspiracy, but it had to do with the way the bus lines were being purchased. And in the end, General Motors was really interested in selling buses, not in selling cars in that instance. So, you know, it's nice to imagine in a way that we didn't do this to ourselves, that General Motors and Ford and so forth foisted these machines upon us. But the reality is that, you know, this was overwhelmingly supported by vast numbers of Americans. They wanted their private automobiles, and they got them.
Okay. Well, Rich, I appreciate that. Let me get back to your phones. Tom in Rochester next. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, I think that we're going to need a manual switch just in case there's a tree in the road, a herd of animals, people rioting, rocks in the road, or the bridge is gone. And the other thing is, let's say you're going down the road and you find out it's a dead end in the woods. Is the car going to know how to turn around and get out of that mess? What about winter? Is the car that arrives at your house going to have a snow shovel, scraper, and a snow brush in it?
Tom, thank you for that. So first of all, everything that Tom is discussing is something that technology has been seeking to address, whether it's road conditions, closeness of other threats, etc. But what he is saying is actually wanting to go to a manual switch to let a driver take over. So Dan Albert, let's talk about the technology. How comfortable do you feel with it right now? And what do you think the ceiling on this technology is?
So I guess I'd just lay out a couple of things. One is this idea of a switch where you can take over as the driver, get to a point where the car says, I can't handle it. Please, you know, you're in charge.
Yep.
Engineers are finding that's one of the most difficult things, and even more difficult than letting the car handle things all the time, because now you have a driver who has to sit there and pay attention with none of the control that they might like to have. In terms of the ability of the driverless car to just navigate the world as it finds it, so far it's proved pretty inadequate. And there are two points I'd make there. One is people may be familiar with Waymo, which is the Google spin-off driverless car company. They operate in Chandler, Arizona. They are not in Rochester. They're certainly not in Boston or Cambridge or, you know, any wintry place where people drive badly. They're in a place where it's sunny and flat and has very good roads. But also, the company has already mapped out this small area very, very carefully. So before these, you know, Waymo vans leave the garage every day, they already have a very good sense of the world around them. So even that, which seems to be the farthest ahead, is not nearly as far as we might think. I will say I'm not that worried about riding in the back of a driverless car, 25 miles an hour. Cars are very safe these days. I would warn people that there really are no driverless cars, despite what Tesla might tell you, on the road today. And so, you know, keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road.
Howard Decker.
We're not that close. I mean, Dan's right. I mean, the technology is not there yet. The driverless car technology has proven to be very poor in rainstorms, very poor in, check this out, Rochesterians, snowstorms, and they don't do really too terrifically with pedestrians. Also, they use a technology called LIDAR, which is light and range detection, I think, or something like that. And it's incredibly expensive at the moment. It's about $75,000 to put one of those coffee cans on the top of your car in order for you to be able to even approach self-driving. So there's a lot of challenges that lie ahead. The technology is quite imperfect as yet. But then I remember that Edison said he'd light up Manhattan, and 4 years later, he did. And when he said that in the first place, there were no power plants, there was no light bulb, there was no wires, there was no nothing. So we can achieve radically rapid changes in our technology in a very short period of time. And that may be what's required here, but we're not there yet. We're just clearly not there yet.
Tom in Brighton wants to talk about how good of drivers human beings are. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, well, really what I'm talking about is putting a bracket around this discussion. We talk about the right to drive, you know, and the gearheads that many of us are, that we just love the machines. But let's get down to something very fundamental. Every single year, at least 37,000 people are killed. And that really puts a bottom line to the discussion. Maybe driverless cars are not ready yet, but when they are, we're kind of mandated by whatever moral standard we have to use it, because we can't accept 37,000 people being killed every year. If driverless cars are going to be safer, then we're obligated to use them.
Tom, thank you for the phone call. I'm going to start with Howard Decker, who's itching to jump in here.
I think there's no question but that the main argument that's used repeatedly in favor of the development of driverless technology is safety. Dan points out significantly in his book that leaving issues of driverless car safety to the automobile industry is probably not the smartest thing we could do. But it is the compelling argument that's made. There are more compelling arguments to make than even 37,000 people die every year in automobile accidents. And, for example, how many people are dying now because of factors related to global warming? And how many will in the future? And perhaps that's an even more compelling statistic than 37,000 people dying annually, which is not to say that's insignificant, but there may be more significant factors to add into the equation as well. But I think that the automobile industry is certainly trying to sell the notion of driverless cars on the basis of safety, without question.
Dan Albert?
I think it's a very interesting question. 37,000, 1.25 million people around the globe die every year from road accidents. The promise, as Howard says, from the automobile industry and the driverless car industry is we're going to cut that factor by 90%. I talk a lot in my book about the idea of the bad driver. 94% of crashes are caused by human error is a very common statistic. It's not actually what the safety people are saying, and I like to say I read the footnotes, and when you read the footnotes, what it actually says is the driver is the last link in the chain that could have avoided a crash. So what does that mean? Imagine a really bad intersection. Say it really should have a traffic light, but it doesn't. And yet every day, thousands of cars go through it without incident. And then we have a crash. By definition, we've already seen thousands of drivers avoid hitting each other. Therefore, driver error has caused this crash. What we don't do is turn that around and say, well, wait a minute, there's something wrong with the infrastructure here. And I think this is especially true in cities where, bicyclists and pedestrians are dying at increasing rates. And the reason is not because drivers are bad per se. It's because the cities lack the infrastructure to provide safe mobility for people who are not in vehicles. So I just want to say I don't like the logical leap from 37,000 people are dying to we must have driverless cars, because to suggest that somehow over the last century, when we've had 30,000, 50,000 people a year dying, we were immoral, and now suddenly we have this moral responsibility, I find very strange. The bottom line is, I like to say, 37,000 people die every year, and, we seem pretty okay with it because we've been letting it happen for 100 years.
Dan, there's also, in my mind, the question of what a litigious society will do, and that is to say, let's say we go from 37,000 to 4,000. Now there are 4,000 deaths, and I presume that would mean pedestrian struck, et cetera, but 4,000 deaths related to automobiles that are now driverless automobiles. And what in the past was a situation in which attorneys could train their sights on someone who's driving a car? Now they can sue an entire company who created that car. So they have fewer opportunities to sue, but they can probably get a lot more money. And now imagine you are part of a society in which, 90% of the automobile-related accident deaths are gone, but you or someone you love is lost, and they're part of the 10%. Are we going to accept the loss of control that people may feel, along with the opportunity to sue and sue someone to the moon because, hey, you told me I didn't have to drive this car. You told my mom she didn't have to drive it. She just had to ride in it. And now she's gone, and we want everything you got, and we're going to shut you down. How long till that happens, Dan?
Well, it's funny. People sometimes say, well, how will you know when driverless cars are here? The day will come that I don't have to buy car insurance. That's when driverless cars are here, where I am no longer fiscally responsible. It's interesting that, you talk about litigiousness. One of the things that's happened over the years is that we've really transformed our judicial system in terms of the automobile so that we don't really carry insurance in order to avoid being sued or to protect us in a suit. In fact, what happens is you get in a fender bender and the insurance companies go at it behind the scenes. But you're absolutely right that as this becomes transferred from individuals with maybe, you know, deep pockets to corporations with bottomless pockets, you will see a change in our attitude toward who's responsible. And I should add that, you know, before the 1960s, with Ralph Nader coming along and other safety advocates and the development of safety belts, the cars were very, very dangerous. And only when we got to the 1960s and Nader began to define them as negligent products, products that were killing people just by virtue of their design, were the car companies put in a place where they really had to make changes.
My guest on the line is Dan Albert. He is a journalist and author of the book, Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless. And in studio with us is Howard Decker, an architect and a board member of the Community Design Center of Rochester. And when we come back, many more of your phone calls and emails as we envision a future of driverless cars in America. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Scott says, whatever happened to the idea of promoting public transit over individual ownership of cars? No one has mentioned this yet, and once again, I feel like Howard's going to come right through that microphone, jumping at this one. Go ahead, Howard.
Yeah, this is one of those subjects that we really need to engage. One of the things that I think we need to think about is, if autonomous vehicles are going to be a solution to something, then we need to figure out what it is we're solving. Well, it's safety, okay? It's a bunch of things. But one of the things that autonomous vehicles will not do is they will not provide a 100% blank slate solution to mass transit. What we're going to need, no matter what we do, driverless or otherwise, is we're going to have to continue to have multiple modes of transportation. I once did a little back of the envelope calculation, and I charted out 28 different modes of transportation: bikes and mopeds and cars and trucks and all different kinds of stuff. And the way we move about our cities and our countryside needs us to continue to pursue, much more aggressively in my opinion than we do, the need for mass transit at lots of different levels. One of the things that autonomous vehicles can do, for example, is give us different kinds, different modes, if you will, of travel, where we don't just travel by ourselves, you know, going to Wegmans and getting your Doritos while you're still texting in your driverless car. But no, actually, maybe you're sharing a ride with your neighbors on your street, or 6 or 10 other people, or 20 or 30, depending upon where you're going and so on. So it's not possible for us to give up the idea of public transportation and multiple modes of transportation in any discussion of driverless cars. Not possible.
Okay. I think the interesting thing is, yeah, I'm sorry, just that, you know, we don't hear a whole lot about driverless buses, and yet the best application from an economic and urban planning point of view, I would think, would come down to buses. I have a fellow who tells me that in London, where the most expensive bus in the world rides, which is the double-decker bus, very expensive to operate, 60% of the cost is the driver. So the operating cost all goes down to labor. So if you imagine eliminating a bus driver, now instead of one bus every 10 minutes, you can have one bus every 5 minutes or 3 minutes. Now you have a mass transit system that operates much, much better for people.
And in a city like ours, Dan, we have buses that are in one or two, maybe three different sizes. And it's easy to imagine in a different world with technology like the technology of autonomous vehicles, that we could have multiple different sizes of vans and buses and so on to do multiple different jobs over multiple different distances. And suddenly it all makes complete sense. One of the questions that comes to my mind is, are the people at our transit agency thinking about this? In fact, some people at some transit agencies are beginning to realize that they need to start planning for autonomous vehicles. And they're starting to think about, just as Dan has said, the fact that a driverless bus is cheaper, more efficient, and gives us a greater range of service than the stuff that we face now. And cities are starting to think about planning for autonomous vehicles. I'm not sure that our city is planning for it. I've just read the proposed 2034 comprehensive plan for the city of Rochester, and I don't remember reading anything about autonomous vehicles. But some cities are seeing that the implications are gigantic. I was with a colleague yesterday who said that she and her fellow architects are now designing parking garages so that they can become obsolete, so that they can become something else. Because clearly they're seeing, oh, we may not need to park all of those cars anymore. So we need to be thinking about what kind of impacts this can have. And one of the things that really is a fabulous opportunity is the extent to which multiple modes of public transit are going to be possible.
All right, Vicky, writing from Penfield, says, no person who talks with philosophical longing about a system of ride-sharing replacing our current system of driving has ever had three children who participate in 9 different activities between them and need to be driven to and picked up from 5 different locations on any given Saturday. I really don't see anything other than a very patient parent behind the wheel accomplishing this. Okay. Go ahead, once again. Let's both go ahead, Dan.
Well, I just, I am 100% with you. I have the minivan. I have the 3 kids. I coach the soccer. We've got, you know, gymnastics, marching band, and so forth. And I point this out, you know, if we had to take Ubers everywhere, we'd probably have like a 1-star rating and get kicked off the app, because what's in the back, you know, wet towels and muddy cleats and all of that. So our minivan really is part of the house. And that multi-faceted journey is still something that we need to do, and we need to have our stuff with us and so forth. So you've really hit on an application where you need or want that private automobile. That doesn't mean, of course, that driverless cars can't be part of the ecosystem, as Howard says, doing all kinds of other jobs. But yeah, 100% with you.
And I think also it's important to realize, while I appreciate what your caller is suggesting, and I think she's exactly correct, kids are 3 different kids, 16 different things to do, 18 different places to go. It all makes complete sense that you have to have a car to do that. But we need to remember that we organized ourselves along the lines of how we're organized physically because of the car. We chose to put the school over here, the playing field over there, our house over there, the store behind us 2 miles. We chose to spread everything out because the car made it possible. So one of the things we can think about, even if we have 3 kids doing 16 different things, one of the things we can think about is how we could organize things physically differently so that we wouldn't have to have the damn van all the trips.
Well, if you go to the Netherlands, if you go to Switzerland,
France, England,
you will
Italy.
Find families of 5 with kids who have a lot of activities on a Saturday. They are simply organized geographically in a way that makes it a different system.
Precisely.
Yeah. So, I mean, so Vicky's not wrong about the current system.
No, she's not wrong at all.
Right. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, I just wanted to add one thing. You know, I'm the stay-at-home parent in a lot of ways in this house, and I'm the one who drives the minivan. The fact, though, is that what you've just heard is a mother's perspective, and the diversity of perspectives going into the development of driverless vehicles, I don't think so far we've seen it there. It's sort of, you know, the tech bro culture. And I think one of the things that needs to be understood is that a much more inclusive approach to planning this future is needed.
As in all things.
Let me get back to your phone calls, and we'll squeeze in as much as we can. Ron in Rochester next. Go ahead, Ron.
Hello. When I called, I had 2 ideas, but a 3rd idea came in your discussion. You talked about liability, and, you know, so if there is an accident in a driverless car, I'm assuming that the car will still be, the driver will still be able to take control over the car, so I can assume that the car companies will say, well, you didn't jump in time to take control of the car, that's why the accident occurred. And then a couple other ideas. One was, been into photography for years, and I know how hard it is for the camera to get the focus. And so I could imagine, like you're talking about rain and snow, I think you know, we're going to have tremendous increase in technology and optics for, you know, for that type of, that part of the car to work properly and safely. And then, the third thing was related to income. A lot of people voted for, you know, Trump because of stagnant wages, stagnant income and stuff. But then if the expenses like cars keep on going up, then no wonder people feel like they can't catch up because their expenses are going out of the roof and their income can't catch up with it.
Dan Albert, what do you think?
Well, to take them in the reverse order, I think one of the most interesting things to me about a change from owning a vehicle to mobility as service is when you own a vehicle, going that extra mile or that extra 100 miles is a very small marginal cost, right? You're already paying insurance, you're already paying for the car. But when you're paying by the mile, now each mile costs the same. To go an extra 100 miles costs an extra 100, right? To go 1,000 miles more is an extra 1,000. So that really does change the economics for the individual in terms of incentivizing you to travel less. Right now you're incentivized in a sense to travel more because every other mile you go, it just gets cheaper and cheaper per mile. In terms of cameras and whatnot, that is a very difficult problem. There are new Tesla has been fighting with Mobileye over who has the best image processing chip. And certainly one of the big concerns has been how quickly can a camera change its focus from very close to very far. That's one of the things, I think, as Howard says, I think will be very quickly resolved. And then the last one in terms of liability, this has been an issue right now because Tesla has what they call autopilot, and there have been now several accidents, including a few deaths, in which autopilot has been implicated. And the company's response is, well, you know, we wrote it in the manual. There's a manual that says, you know, pay attention, and therefore we're not responsible. And so that will have to get worked out down the line.
Okay. Well, in our last couple of minutes then here, Dan, you know, you wrote this book, Are We There Yet?, as a work of scholarship. And listeners, you can pick it up now. It's available. It's called Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless. And, you know, you joked as being a stay-at-home dad. I hope everyone picks up your book, by the way, Dan. But I also want to ask you, who are you hoping most picks up this book, whether it's policymakers, whether it's people within the automobile industry? Who would you love to see tear through this book and really consider its implications?
I think what I kept in mind all the time when I was writing it is don't be boring. And what I mean by that is it should be, I hope, appealing to somebody who not necessarily that into cars or hasn't really thought about the driverless future. I certainly think there are things that people in the industry and so forth, scholars will get out of it. But really, and this is what's so great for me to take your listeners' calls, is I hope this is a doorway through which people can begin to enter this conversation with people like Howard and myself who studied it at length, because I really do think this future is not something we want to leave to Silicon Valley or General Motors or even particularly the federal government. I think really people need to be focused on this and engaged with it, and I'm tried to make this an enjoyable path into that conversation.
What do you want people thinking about as we leave this conversation, Howard Decker?
That we're headed to driverless cars, and we need to think about what that means for all of us so that we don't get trapped into living the same kind of life with a different kind of tool. A driverless car is a different tool, and it can give us new opportunities in the same way that the first car did at the turn of the last century. And now is our chance to begin to think about what that could mean for our future. That's why I think Dan is exactly correct. The people who need to read his book are the people who say, well, I've just got to have my car, and there's no alternative. I need to cars. You know, that's I'm totally embedded in the culture of cars. Those are the people I want to read Dan's book because those are the ones for whom I would like to see some questions begin to dawn, like, oh, do we really need to live this way? There really might be alternatives that might lead us to a better life. I wonder what's going to happen. And then those people who become better informed, as Dan is suggesting, will weigh in as this unfolds and possibly steer us in a better direction.
Well, as Willie Vanderbilt loved speed and so many others love speed, maybe one day the future entails a kind of entertainment industry in which we go skydiving now because we love the thrill. Maybe someday you'll go to a theme park to drive a car yourself, just like they used to do.
Just like Seabreeze.
In the old days. Wouldn't that be an amazing thing? Dan Elbert, the author of Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless. Great fun this hour. Congratulations on the book. It's available now. And Dan, thanks for taking the time for us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And Howard Decker, an architect and a board member of the Community Design Center of Rochester, probably peeling out of here on a motorcycle.
No doubt about it.
Or some doubt about it. Thank you.
Always. It's
As
a pleasure.
As always.
It's a pleasure.
Listeners, I want to thank Gary Puttup for the work all week behind the glass with us. Thankfully for Gary and for me and for the listeners, producer Megan Mack will be back on Monday. Rob Braden, the engineer, who's had to endure Gary back there and somehow has come through unscathed. And to all of the people who volunteer, including Tim Shea. Great stuff, Tim. Thank you. Great having you. I'm Evan Dawson. Listeners, wherever you are and however you're getting there, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you Monday on member-supported public radio.